What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Stephen Chow is an art patron. 100% of his savings goes to supporting his favorite living artists. His goal is to support living artists from as many cultures as he can, working in a wide variety of mediums and cultural traditions. He would rather sponsor one new masterpiece from an artist of his choosing at his own expense, knowing full well that it could fail, than be given all of the lost masterpieces in the history of art. In his free time, he transcribes Bitcoin podcasts into the written medium, contributing to the ecosystem in his own unique and artistic way. Stephen Chow, welcome to the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. How are you?
Thank you, Cedric. I'm honored to be here.
Yeah, man.
It's been exciting doing all the transcripts for you. And I'm in the middle of doing the one for John Vallis, actually.
Nice.
So it's fun to kind of switch back and forth and switch into being into the podcast itself.
Right. That's funny. Well, we do have that connection. And I got a real kick out of it, especially the first one that you transcribed. I mean, just seeing it in the written form. And I really saw that it connected with different people. That particular show got a bump right away. Then it's pretty cool to see, you know, the things that you pull out of them, like what quotes are interesting to you across all the pods you transcribe. So, I mean, how long have you been transcribing Bitcoin podcasts?
That's a good question. It started with Stefan Lavera podcast, maybe could even be a couple of years ago, maybe 18 months ago. There was a bunch of podcasts I was doing for Stefan Lavera, probably late 2019, something like that. And that just got into a lot of like more technical interviews with like Samurai Wallet and hardware wallet manufacturers. I think Bitcoin Takeover podcast, I did a lot of transcripts for each hardware wallet manufacturer. Mm-hmm. And then I just picked up again over the past year. I guess I got distracted for a while and came back to it now. Now I'm doing a deep dive in transcripts.
What's the motivation? Why just start? You know, I mean, it's, you just rattled off a whole bunch, but I still don't, like, why just start and what motivates you to do it?
I get a real kick out of seeing other people getting value out of the transcripts. And I think I said to someone before, like, I've gotten a ton of value reading transcripts that other people have done, sometimes anonymously. Like these transcripts from Terence McKenna come to mind from his website. And I don't know. It's a huge amount of stuff that I'm learning from these transcripts that I wouldn't have gotten from listening to the podcasts, because I just get so much more out of it when I'm reading it instead of listening. So I just figure that other people are the same way, and they're appreciative when it's all written down that way.
Right. How long does it take you to transcribe, like an hour?
So it would have to be, I'd be listening at half speed and just going over each sentence maybe two or three times. So it would take many, many days actually to do 1 hour. But that's more of me being undisciplined and getting distracted all the time by Bitcoin Twitter. If I just sat down and went straight through it, it might take like 5 or 6 hours to do 1 hour of audio.
Right. and do you see it as like an art form, its own medium?
I think I've compared it to like translating poetry in a way, where you have to really make sure that you're channeling the voice of each character in each speaker in the interview. And that I think that totally gets lost when you run a transcript through like an AI transcription bot or something. It just completely loses that character that you, and you kind of have to put that back into it when you're doing it manually or when you're editing it again.
Do you think podcasting is an art form or a medium of its own and or a modern one? Or if it is, maybe it's a traditional one just with a new recording system.
I guess podcasts are, to me, are like, I don't know. I kind of imagine like Plato's Dialogues being a podcast in a way. Right. And it'd be fun if we could have had those recorded in that fashion. So I guess I just see it as like a very ancient tradition. It's just in a new form that we can digest through the internet instead of having to sit by the campfire or something, which would probably be better, but it's much more distributable.
Right. Would Twitter and I guess Clubhouse be in the same way? Kind of just modern forms of capturing these conversations? Or yeah, are they new forms of something?
I guess I haven't gotten a lot out of Clubhouse, actually, because right. I can't return to the conversations. That's the big issue for me. It's like a live event and you don't get to see it again after that. I don't know. I like having like physical books or physical CDs around. I need to really return to these things over and over again every year. Otherwise, I just completely forget what was said.
Right. Well, in terms of that, like physical things and collectibles, how long have you been collecting things?
I feel like I was born that way. I was born collecting things right. from the age of 4. It started with like seashells and like pet rocks and stuff like that. My parents were just, they just fed the flame, and I was collecting things all through childhood into high school and college. And I just kept trying to upgrade them from like war game, miniature games to video games to books to antique books and eventually to original art and art by living artists. I kind of see that as a trajectory where the quality of the work was getting upgraded over time until the pinnacle for me is getting to the museum quality masterpieces. That's what I'm really after.
Right. When you said your parents fed the flame, was that a positive thing? Like, you mean they were supportive or more of like a pushing thing?
Oh yeah, they were like endlessly supportive of that. They kind of let me do my own thing, and I guess I naturally was gravitating to collecting things for some reason. That's just what I did on my own. So I think my parents were very wise to just let that be and support it in any way that they could without trying to direct it or to try to control it. So I think it kind of evolved very as naturally as it could have evolved.
Right. And then did you at some point start making art rather than just collecting?
Yeah, I think from high school through college, I thought that was what I was supposed to be doing was making art myself. It's funny, like I think in my mind, I thought that it would be cheaper to paint my own reproductions of masterpieces instead of trying to go buy them, buy the original. And I was thinking in that way, like, how could I save money and just make reproductions or old master copies and take that approach to study artworks. That didn't last very long though. It was maybe like 4 years where I was studying painting.
That's still a long time. You know, I mean, it's like 25% of your life at that point. That's know, true. In that perspective.
Yeah. I just got very disillusioned by painting on my own because in the back of my mind, I knew that I didn't have a very strong like cultural upbringing or a very strong religious upbringing. And the artwork that I was making, it just didn't have a lot of, it didn't have a lot of meaning to it. I don't know. I look at a lot of artists and they just can't help but impart meaning into their work from all kinds of sources. And I just felt like I didn't have that.
Right. I think that's, you know, a really interesting inflection point. I wonder, you know, I think a lot of people go through that. It's whether like, do you personally, and you in the sense of the general understood, have talent? And you wonder, do other people just have talent and they're just, you know, like you said, they're able to draw from other sources and put inspiring things in front of you or challenging things in front of you.
Yeah.
Or is it sort of the other side of the coin where it's, well, you know, maybe I have talent, maybe I have ambition or creativity, but I don't have enough life experience yet to draw from other sources. And, you know, maybe it's like, I feel like there's that big fork in the road where it's like, do I need to put 20, 30 more years into this craft?
Yeah.
While gaining life experience to then combine the two, or do I, you know, step aside and maybe not go down this path because maybe this is not, you know, maybe I'm not the top 100 of X in the world.
Yeah. I remember in particular, I was studying Peter Paul Rubens in college and he had some crazy like humanist background where he was studying ancient Greek and Latin and he had access to all kinds of knowledge, cultural knowledge that he was putting into his oil paintings. And I remember in college that I just had no idea what any of that stuff was. And I felt so like unprepared to be painting anywhere near the level that he was because I didn't have that, that like liberal arts education. So I was much more obsessed about how could I become liberally educated before I could even think about starting to paint. And after pursuing those studies, I think that's when I realized that there were all these artists that were already prepared to make artwork with that kind of background in mind. It kind of evolved to where I could just start. It made more sense to just support artists that were already prepared to do that.
I want to get into definitely supporting art artists and art patronage. I am curious though, whether these other artists who, you know, maybe have this cultural or religious, I'm not sure if it's background or education or studies, you think kind of gives them this perspective or ability, or, you know, again, is it something maybe like you alluding to, maybe they were born into a house that kind of had these notions and science and religious and cultural stuff going on, or they're just where their interests were, or they just kind of pick up that stuff intuitively?
Yeah, it's hard for me to say because I feel like my education is just totally chaotic and pulling from a really chaotic like amount of eclectic sources. And I don't know, it's like when the artists that I look at now, they have a very strong cultural identity, but they're also pulling in from other inspirations or influences on top of that. Whereas I just feel like totally disconnected from everything, like equally distant from everything. So, I mean, from my perspective, I kind of feel like a tourist when I'm looking at different cultures. I don't really feel like I was like born into a certain culture or practice. I guess other than the books that I mostly studied, which were like in the liberal arts tradition or like a Catholic tradition, where you just study everything in like in a generalist way.
Yeah, I really want to get more into this, a little bit more of the cultural and religious, but I kind of want to just get a little more context. So you've given over 140,000 to living artists since 2016. And I just kind of want to get a little bit more context on what art patronage is.
Yeah.
And how do you go about connecting with artists and distributing this money, and what happens in return?
So that started mostly with just trying to purchase artworks directly from artists that had already been created. It took a while. It took a few years for this to like morph into how can I sponsor projects that don't exist yet, or how can I help the artist do something that they themselves want to create, that they just need some kind of runway to fund it for. It's like how can I step out of the picture and not be an art director, because the problem that I kept seeing in the art world, at least from say like the entertainment industry with artwork for video games, was that the art director was causing all the problems. They weren't allowing these brilliantly talented artists to, I don't want to say like do whatever they want, but like have enough creative freedom to like fully express themselves. That was what was really missing to me, was how do you get the artists to have creative freedom and also the funding to be able to afford to do that work?
Do you think there are, you know, more talented, you know, artists today than there were, you know, 1,000 years ago, whether they're discovered or not? Sort of like, and what I'm getting at there is like, you know, sports is a clear meritocracy in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And I believe that, you know, athletes are getting better over time,
mm-hmm.
and that there are just more, you know, markets being tapped into. So more people have opportunity and more talent rises to the top. And so you can kind of make that argument, whereas I don't know about with art, and there are different issues here. It's like there's modern art, and what we can talk about fiat's influence on that or different things. But just the notion of, do you think there's a lot more, do you think there's a lot of talented art that aren't being discovered, and or is there more talent today than yesteryear?
I think I just look at that based on the total population of the world, that there just has to be more like 1 in a million talents out there, based on the statistics. But I guess if you look at it from that way, like when I compare that to like professional basketball or something, they know that they're getting paid like $20 million a year at the highest level. Whereas for art, that incentive isn't necessarily there yet in someone's mind when they're a student. So I guess in a way I'm trying to put a carrot on a stick in a way for the highest quality work, and see how I can reward, I want to say like a meritocracy or an aspiration to artistic excellence in a way that actually is museum quality. Because I think that's gotten corrupted in a lot of ways. There are a lot of incentives for artwork, but I think they're not necessarily asking for what I have in mind as museum quality artwork.
Right. I'm still caught up on this hinge of, I heard you talk a little bit about like, you know, people are more today inspired and motivated to sponsor like a portrait of their dog than they are to be an art patron.
Yeah.
And I counter that with, you know, there's a lot of free art available now, or free being, you know, like music that's abundant. and easy accessible, and sometimes quote unquote free via advertising, whether it's the radio or whatever, and, and film and verse, like, you know. And so what made you like more inspired, I think, to kind of to take this on upon yourself? Because it almost feels like maybe you're throwing rocks at the, you know, or sand at the ocean. And like, you know, do you, and like, how much of a difference does $150,000 make? And I'm not trying to belittle that. I'm just, you know, like, I find it inspiring what you're doing. And I'm just trying to question, like, and I'm trying to get at, like, what do you think of modern art and sort of like current music today and film, and how do you get across to people? Like, yeah, maybe you'd get better stuff if you actually paid for better stuff. But I feel like most, I would feel like, where do I start? You know, like, how do I, I'm a patron. How do I make a difference? And I also wonder, is like, is my Netflix subscription dollar cost averaging into art? And I don't know if that's a good or bad thing.
Yeah. So I think, first of all, like, something like Patreon really doesn't appeal to me, or crowdfunding in general, because I don't know, for some reason, like, I've been listening to like death metal since I was like 14. Somehow I ran into like metal guitarists when I was 14 and got into metal for like the last 20 years. And just the recurring theme is that the best quality metal music is just not popular at all in the mainstream. And they make almost no money out of it, even though it's the highest quality music out there. And I think that applies to most art forms, where it's a really small market for like the highest possible quality artwork out there. And if you really care about it, it just takes like maybe three or four super fans to just put all of that funding to make that happen. And especially with the music, what I generally see is the musicians themselves will just self-fund the album production, or all the costs of recording the album. And that could be like $50,000 or something, or $100,000 just to record one album. So I kind of take that as the general rule, where if you really want like the greatness, the highest quality work to exist, someone has to step up and contribute way more than you might expect from like a pool of like 10,000 fans or 100,000 fans. It takes one crazy patron to make the really nice stuff exist, is how I look at it.
Right. Was patronage, I mean, I think that was something that was more common hundreds of years ago. Can you talk about maybe the history of patronage? And are you like bringing something back that kind of was in a more larger fashion?
Yeah, I haven't studied the history of patronage a whole lot, but the general idea is typically like the most powerful person in a civilization had the most wealth, and they had like they controlled most of the money, and it was basically up to them to be the patron of art or culture. And I guess they took it upon themselves to do that for the community, almost like a civic duty. But that was also tied into religion or the culture as well. So I guess it wasn't as common for like an everyday person to have the means available to, I don't know, sponsor a Michelangelo or have an artist in residence or something. I think that was a cultural shift as you get more into the modern era, where you can kind of decentralize patronage to middle classes or lower classes. and especially so with Bitcoin.
There's a quote in on your website by Ezra Pound. If a patron buys from an artist who needs money to buy tools, time, and food, the patron then makes himself equal to the artist. He is building art into the world he creates. One, can you comment a bit on that quote and why you chose to share it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's, I think Ezra Pound is probably my favorite commentator on patronage. And it's precisely because of that quote. It's kind of elevating the importance of patronage. It's not just about like a buyer and a seller. There's like all kinds of connoisseurship going on when a patron decides what he's paying for or what he's refusing to pay for. There's a lot of qualitative judgment going on there. So when I look at art that was sponsored in history, what doesn't get talked about is what money wasn't spent on other things that were lower quality, or potentially higher quality.
Right.
So you don't see the other options that those patrons had in history, and all you see is what they happened to spend their money on. So that's very different from today, because today you can see every possible option that you could spend the money on. And I think that probably gets lost over the centuries. I think that's a major difference between what, well, it's just really hard to get into that mindset of like what did patrons like 500 years ago, like what options did they have? It's really hard to figure that out.
Right. What is it, how do you connect with artists? And what is sort of that introductory period like where you're trying to sponsor something and, you know, maybe, I don't know if sometimes they get bigger eyes and how do you walk through what you're going to be willing to financially sponsor and what you're going to be looking to partake in or which kind of piece? And maybe like what I'm getting at there is like, you know, maybe you've seen their artwork and you're like, oh, I think that would probably cost like $5,000 to make, but if this person had $15,000, they could do something even greater, but maybe they're going to ask you for $55,000.
Yeah. So I feel like I've taken baby steps in that direction. And I've only worked with like one or two artists where the numbers are getting into like the five figures. So I think I lost the original question.
Sure, but like, how do you, you know, what is the introductory period like? You know,
introductory period. Yeah.
Period. Introduce yourself. You know, I'm assuming digitally, and how does that conversation progress? And what is that relationship like? And how much of a curator are you in the process?
Hmm. So most of the research is going on Instagram. Actually, the most effective way that I found artists on Instagram is actually purchasing ads, kind of advertising that I am sponsoring artists, and just getting like inbound, I guess, introductions from artists that I've never heard of from all over the place. I'm pretty sure that's how I found like Morgan Asaf and Philip Slater. They saw that ad and just posted a comment on the ad, and it went from there. So I don't know if that's like serendipity, but I was like, the reason why I did that was I was looking for ways to find artists that I might not have known how to look for. So how do you like create all these different
mouse traps? Or
yeah, it's like a mouse trap. How do you create traps that you can't even imagine yourself or imagine how to create yourself?
How many images have you looked at?
If I could put a number on it, it might be like 2 or 3 million. Wow. Maybe more than that. Maybe 6 million. I have no idea.
And
it's a huge number.
What's the, I guess the process there, is that like, are you taking in like 10,000 in an hour? Is it like 10 a day and you just, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. And do you, is there a point where like, do, I guess too, but how often do you find an inspiring image, and maybe how often have you maybe seen an inspiring or seen an image and not been inspired by it in that moment, maybe passed up on a good one? Through either just exhaustion, yeah. You know, or just, you know, lack of expectation maybe, or.
Yeah, that's a tough one. It's like I'm always like skeptical that I know what I'm looking at. There's a lot of cases where I think I might be totally mistaken. I guess I rely on intuition to figure that out. I kind of have a gut reaction in a split second when I see something that's really powerful to me. And I try to trust that. But yeah, it's like I looked at probably hundreds of thousands of images on eBay, and then probably even more on Instagram. And just comparing the two, it's like, it's very different flavors of images, I guess.
In what way? Like, you mean, because they're different platforms, they get very different content and, or some other fashion?
I think on eBay, you see, I mean, there's so many like fake objects on eBay, and it's like 90% deception. They're just trying to sell you something for cash, and they don't care if you're happy with the purchase. Whereas on Instagram,
You're really
seeing like the personal portfolio of individual artists, and it's easier on Instagram to find the really passionate artworks, like really personal projects that artists are working on. Whereas on eBay, you'll find those occasionally, but they're secondhand. And probably from artists that were alive 100 years ago or 200 years ago.
If you work with like 10 artists or know of 10 artists, what would be the number or percentage of them that are working as an artist and eking out or doing well at being an artist financially versus doing another job and just doing the art in their spare and free time? In terms of the artist at a level that you'd want to sponsor.
It's probably like 90% that are full-time artists that are making a living doing it. I don't know if I was like self-selecting for that. That's hard to say. But a lot of the artists have been working for like 15 years or more full-time, and that in itself is extremely rare. To be able to do that. And then it's like they're making work on a different level. It's like the quality of the materials are lower when they're selling maybe lower priced work, but that's kind of what sustains their income.
Sure.
And it's like what I'm looking for is how can I sponsor projects that make no compromises whatsoever on the highest end level. And those are the kind of projects that the artists they're thinking about, but they don't know how to pay for those yet.
Do you find that all the artists you want to sponsor actually do want to take those risks? Or are there some that you feel like, hey, that, you know, or even they may clearly like say, I don't want to go that far in terms of either my time or the cost, because I want to stick to maybe this more sustainable thing.
Well, at least all the artists that I've spoken to, they're like super ambitious. I remember Anthony Goonan telling me one time, like, if you give me a church, I'll just paint the whole church by myself. So these guys are like, they're like superheroes to me. They can do anything if they put their mind to it.
What does it mean when you say something like, you know, you need to almost hate a piece of work before you like it or judge it to be a really inspiring or, you know, a piece that just kind of breaks through?
So that goes back to, I don't know if you're familiar with like the Great Books program. I guess it started in Chicago, where they were teaching like a canon of Western literature or philosophy. And I think this was started by Mortimer Adler in the 50s in Chicago, at the University of Chicago, actually. And his thesis, I guess, was that the highest quality books are constantly going over your head. And you have to attack it, even though you're almost like totally ignorant of what they're talking about. And I approach artwork the same way. It's like you can kind of sense that there's a lot going on there, but you don't fully understand it. And it's going to take many, many years, if not decades, to get your head around it. And I guess that, to me, that reaction is generally hatred at first glance. It's like hatred of the unknown or hatred of things that you don't understand that are maybe too deep or too profound or too complicated. And that's kind of like a sign to me that I need to come back to it. I need to return to it over and over again, because there's a lot more going on there than I can sense right now.
Yeah. One dichotomy I kind of want to get at is, you know, this notion of like, you almost have this hatred of the art when you first see it. And there's this other conversation around like a lot of modern art is makes a statement. And a lot of those statements are almost anti-religious or anti, let's call it mainstream culture or tradition or whatever it is. And you've mentioned a lot that like religion and culture and those influences help pieces transcend time. Can you kind of talk a little bit about like what it means or how hard it is to make art that doesn't make a statement?
That's a terribly difficult question. It's like, what is it? It kind of reminds me of like what makes a masterpiece a masterpiece.
Right.
And it reminds me too of like, I'm thinking of like Asian art, like ancient art in Asia, where there isn't an explicit culture or religion. It's like very, very abstract. I'm thinking of like ancient vases or stones or ancient bonsai trees, where you're kind of appreciating nature for itself and kind of appreciating nature, but nature on its own terms. But I guess that's still different from an artwork that's like devoid of meaning.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Oh no. It's like, I guess I'm trying to figure out how to approach that question.
Right. Maybe more comments or do you have a take on a lot of the majority of modern art today and what kind of is trendy versus what transcends? And I think it relates to like the artist, the motivation of the artist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and what artist motivated by right now? But, and I guess, I mean, I'm kind of curious if you have a take then, if we want to roll it into like on Banksy or like Damien Hirst and a lot of, or like the banana on the wall artwork.
Yeah. To be honest, I haven't thought much, if anything, on these topics, or like NFTs, for example. I kind of see it as a distraction.
Right.
Because there's so much study that needs to be done on artwork that, like, I already can recognize are masterful. Or potentially masterpieces. So I turn a blind eye right now to most of this type of artwork that's out there on the market. And that's generally artwork that gets talked about in the news or in the like major art galleries or major social media accounts for artwork. You could say I really just don't study that stuff at all.
I once had the opportunity to go into a room where there were 8 Rothkos.
Okay.
And so the room was like, I don't know if it was like 60 feet by 40 feet, you know, so you got like these 30 foot, 40 foot walls. So that would have, you know, 2 Rothkos on a wall.
Yeah.
It was probably like, you know, 14 feet by 22 feet. Mm-hmm. And you know, I've never really studied, well, I've studied some art history, but not, you know, as a scholar. And
yeah.
And I love, you know, I'm inundated with music by choice, yeah. But I do, and most of the music I listen is not current modern pop, but like sometimes mm-hmm. I listen to pop, but I understand like this low time preference, kind of lots of music. And I do wish there were more like Mozart's and Beethoven's or people who took 20 years to make a song. And yeah. I'm in this room and there's probably $500 million of Rothkos around me.
Right.
And it was a very strange experience because the knowledge that what it was worth, I think, was more impactful than the actual art to me.
Mm-hmm.
And also being told, and you're being told by what it's worth. You're being told that it's got artistic value. And I don't know if I felt that or mm-hmm. What I felt was artistic and I'm misplacing, you know, but like, you know, it almost feels really hard to find or search for art and find meaning in the world. And I wonder how much time, like, do you spend in museums and how impactful museums are to you? Or do you go to, like, spend times in parks to be around parks that are known for having art? Or is it just the art you collect in your apartment is sufficient to nourish you?
I'd say... It's like it's necessary for me to go into museums once in a while, but it's really like maybe 1 or 2 times a year. It's not all the time at all. I think I've just gotten to a point where I can kind of tell just looking through a computer screen like what I'm seeing, like the quality of the work. In terms of the materials or how it looks in at different angles, but that's after having spent a ton of time in museums,
or
in libraries. Was that like
from a point of research, or did you find that time inspiring?
I think going into museums actually like put a chip on my shoulder. It was like I was upset at the curator's choices for what they were putting in front of me. Because I was constantly looking for like I very rarely felt like what was put on a pedestal in front of me was the best possible work that could have been there. So after I came home from visiting museums, all I wanted to do was start researching and try to find something better that could have been in the place of that stuff. So I guess I took my visits to museums as a challenge in terms of, okay, this is what the curators think is the best work that they can find. And now let me go do my own research and I'll find something myself and see how that holds up.
If like you were like on a desert island and you could bring like 10 forms of art with you.
Yeah.
And, you know, that includes, you know, paintings, sculptures, but also maybe a song or a film. What do you think would compose the art you would bring? Would it be all sculptures and paintings, or would you bring other sort of mediums like film and art, film and music?
I actually find music to be like way more powerful these days, or maybe it's always been. It's like, if I was bringing 10 pieces of artwork, it might be like 9 pieces of music and maybe one sculpture. That's probably what I would do.
How would I find that, like, because I think I would be along the same lines, and that makes me think, you know, how I view the world. It's like, I feel that like art is really just like a hard place to spend my time in terms of return versus music or film. You know, I can listen to the music in the car, I can take it on a jog, I can be on the island with it.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, I fill my house, and I think we all do, with artifacts, whether it's like when we travel. And like, how different is like picking up a knickknack on vacation, and maybe it's a nice piece of art or you know, the nicest thing that you like, versus seeking out what you're doing online and seeking out like the world's greatest sculpture?
It's like a totally, to me, it's a totally different motivation. I'm trying to find work that will leave a legacy. Like, it could be hundreds of years from now. It's like when I'm trying to sponsor something, I'm trying to get someone 500 years from now to be like thankful that this thing exists. And to me, that's a totally different motivation than like decorating a house or like doing interior decoration, which is, I would look at that more as a temporary thing or more transitory. I look at it like the world's heritage. Like, how can you add something permanent to the world's heritage that everybody can enjoy in the future?
Could you name like maybe something that was made 500 or 1,000 years ago, piece of art that you're thankful exists today?
I mean, almost anything that I can think of in the existing museums and libraries. I try to be like very appreciative of these things, and especially so when they've been digitized. Like, I'm constantly looking through like old books or old artworks that have been digitized online, and I'm learning so much from these things. So it's like, I don't think of it often, but I am actually thankful of very ancient patronage that happened, that I don't know anything about, but it did happen. And I'm pretty sure that most of the patronage, like most of the artwork in museums, were done by a single patron, just working with like one-on-one with an artist. I wouldn't expect a whole lot of these paintings or sculptures to have been like crowdfunded in a way.
On that note, like, how has Bitcoin sort of, you know, influenced or affected the way you do your patronage? And do you think, is Bitcoin in of itself art, or is there Bitcoin art that you're inspired by?
It's definitely like, I guess I'm thinking of from Safe Dean's podcast. Like I came into the art world with a low time preference, and I feel like Bitcoin just expanded it exponentially, and also gave me a lot more options in terms of like the level of ambition that I could have in my mind of what might happen 20 years from now or 40 years from now, and what I could do with Bitcoin with several decades from now. But I think like most of the things that I want to be doing in the future are just totally unknown to me at the moment. I really feel like I'm just like almost entirely in the dark about what the possibilities are right now. And that's what's most exciting to me, is there's so much that needs to be explored and discovered.
Right. Did you start Art Patronage before you found Bitcoin?
A little bit before. It was like 2016. In the documentary, I mentioned a photographer, John Dykstra, that I had sent $20,000 to for his photography projects. And I guess he probably initiated this whole idea of patronage because he sent me an email back in 2016 kind of proposing that something like this could happen. And after a couple of weeks just sending emails back and forth, that was the first time where I really felt like I was supporting an artist in a major way. And it just kind of snowballed from there into 2017, running into Anthony Gunin and Yuri Yurin, the two Russian iconographers.
Right. And so so is Bitcoin just more of an empowerment tool for your ambition and your vocation of being an art patron? Is it sort of just like rocket fuel or more like a treasury reserve asset that gives you like optionality to do this in some form?
Yes. As far as I can tell, it's basically acting as rocket fuel. I'm not sure yet about Bitcoin as art in itself. I don't really have a good way to look at that yet on whether or not Bitcoin is art.
What about some of the art that it's inspired? And not so much to comment on whether you found like a masterful piece, but do you think that might be like, and I don't want to call it a genre, but where maybe a lot of inspiring artists might put forth efforts? Whether it's clothes, music, literature, and art itself, like sculptures and things of that nature.
I guess with Bitcoin art, I'm mainly interested in the memes, because I think that for some reason they're like way more powerful to me than the artworks that are being made for Bitcoin. I guess Bitcoin memes kind of encapsulate better what I have in mind of like what Bitcoin art should be used for. It's like it should convince you to become a Bitcoiner. And I guess that works better in a meme format than as visual art or as digital art. I think that's how I look at it. I guess maybe You could even argue like maybe it defeats the purpose of art if it's only created to be to like promote Bitcoin but on its own or to celebrate Bitcoin. I don't know if you looked at it like as propaganda or something.
Right.
Maybe it's dangerous to think of art as something that should be used to promote Bitcoin. And then it should just be allowed to do its own thing.
Well, that's interesting. How do you separate money from art? I really find it extremely difficult, especially the art I come across in like the bigger headlines. You know, you could avoid mainstream news or media, but you're still going to come across these headlines or this art piece sold for $350 million or $60 million or $80 million. And all I think about is money laundering and reputation washing and
And
sort of like jacked up opinions that don't have a lot of basis. And it just, I find it really hard to get excited about art in that regard.
Yeah, mentally, I've tried to keep things completely separated or compartmentalized where Bitcoin is perfectly fine as a store of value and for storing wealth. And I don't think about art at all in terms of buying and selling or using it as an investment vehicle or anything like that. I think that's very dangerous too, because it kind of pulls you away from what I think art should be used for, which I guess is like to be life affirming or like to, when I see a masterpiece of artwork, it's like, that's why I'm here. It's like, that's what makes life worth living for me. A masterful artwork or a masterful piece of music or a film. And I think to put a price tag on that as something that could be potentially sold later for profit is kind of like contaminating the waters to me. I really try to think of artwork as a pure like service to humanity. It's like something that should be a gift to the world if it's possible to give it out in that way.
Well, I think it truly is a gift. I mean, not only are you empowering the artist, but you're that art is then being shared with the world. I truly feel when a piece of art is created, I don't care how many collaborators there are, there is no owner at that point. It just exists. Mm-hmm. And it's there for the people to take it in. And that's why I try to separate the artist from the art, especially around artists that might have controversial pasts. And sometimes it seeps in and I don't like, it gets the best of me. But most of the time, if I like art, the artist backstory can be separated out.
Yeah.
What I'm getting at here, though, a little bit is like money and art is very difficult for me to separate both what you hear financially and what art can be. I know you don't see it as an investment. I don't either, but you hear about it a lot from that perspective. And it's hard for people to separate themselves from their money. And I wonder, like, how much do you give up? Like, do you live like a monk to support these projects, or like, do you have these moments where you're like, I would love to, get that nice hot chocolate, versus if I could find another $1,000 for this project, boy, what we're going to really create something special here, and that is the gift. I mean, whatever you're giving, but like, at some point, are you taking away from yourself?
Yeah, I tend to think in those terms, like how can I increase the budget for this particular art project? I think in terms of like treating myself, that doesn't even enter the conversation in my mind. It's like if I'm treating myself, I'm buying myself like a couple of books a year or something. So it's very sparingly done, and it's done for like educational purposes. Yeah, it's like I'm trying to leave a lot of space for like hundreds and hundreds of artists to be able to support hundreds of artists in the future. So I feel like I can't. I don't even want to like treat myself with certain things. I feel like very mission oriented. That's what my mission is to sponsor as many of these projects as I can find.
Let's say someone was very rich, very wealthy, and they had a choice between buying this art. And again, I'm not getting into the financial gain for the artist, but they're like, I want to own this art for myself. I have the money.
Yeah.
They're saying, I would, you know what, I'm going to do without, and I'm going to take some of this money to sponsor even more art.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm getting at here is, do you think like more people should be trying to live and or to be a patron and kind of more austere? Or, you know, is there room for both and for people to partake in the art and for that rich person to buy it and consume instead of produce, whether it's, you know, through self-sacrifice and being a patron? Or, you know, is there a place for both? Because I get at, like, you know, back in the day, like you were saying, like, not everyone could afford to be a patron.
Yeah.
But some people could probably afford to give up some stuff to be a patron.
Yeah,
you know, and
I think I don't know. I read a quote recently, which it basically presented patronage as an extremely difficult task, and it's not something that you can just hand people money and they can suddenly become effective patrons.
Right.
It's more likely that they would start sponsoring artists that really shouldn't have that power.
Right. Now we're getting into fiat.
Yeah.
And easy money.
It's like I guess patronage you can look at as an art form,
mm-hmm.
and it probably does take a tremendous amount of skill to not only say yes to certain things, but to say no to every other thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. How much do you get at that? Like, where, you know, we were talking before about, like, you know, kind of building a funnel, I think would be a better word, to kind of get, you know, people who are interested in self-selecting themselves into patronage. But how many, mm-hmm. you know, how much do you deal with people who are just trying to, like what you were saying before, just trying to get money or come into that funnel for not the right reason? You know, to how many people do you have to say no to? Maybe even they're very good artists, but you can't sponsor everybody. You know, it's kind of like I've studied like even like philanthropy. And it's like, let's say no matter how much money you have, you mm-hmm. have a choice. Do I want to touch, like, you know, maybe you want to do a job fair and you want to, you know, there's 1,000 people there, but it's only for an hour long, the job fair. So you can touch a lot of people lightly, or maybe you're going to do like a jobs program and hire, you know, 10 people at X amount of dollars per year and not touch a lot of people, but touch a few people deeply.
Yeah. It's like, you have to really track down the people that are truly passionate about it for the right reasons. The motivation has to be for the right reasons in terms of, like we're talking about, like it can't be for fiat reasons. I think it probably has a corrupting influence and it clouds this obsessive pursuit of quality, in the artwork. Because that's all I'm really after, is like the museum quality and whether or not these works will stand the test of time, and how powerful the artworks are. And I think that takes a certain mentality or a certain patron to have that mindset. And you just have to filter for those.
Hmm. In some way, do you think a patron can discover an artist?
I feel like there's a ton of like neglected geniuses out there that just don't have an audience, even though they have a website or they're online all over the place. They just kind of fall through the cracks, and they have to be discovered online. I feel like Yuri Aaron was a case like that, even though he's like, I think he's in his like late 60s by now, but I can't find anybody else online that is aware of who he is. And he's doing like incredible work in mosaics, and it's like the best mosaic work I've ever seen in the world, but it just got totally lost on the internet. The only people that really know who he is like a very small workshop in Finland. And that's how I discovered him on Instagram. So I'm convinced that there's like thousands of artists like that out there on the internet that are just like really the best artists at what they do in the world. And they just don't have enough eyes on them yet to be discovered.
What does a world with better art or art with more discovered talent look like?
I think that's the kind of world that I would like to live in. And I'm kind of thinking like over the past 20 years, I've seen glimpses of that, like seeing artists having the leisure and the funding to create exactly what they wanted to create. I'm thinking especially in metal music. I'm like extremely grateful for these projects that have been able to be created that I've seen over the past 20 years. And it would just be incredible to see that happen for millions of artists or tens of thousands of artists.
Well, let's say like someone gave you, $1 billion.
Yeah.
And we're like, your patronage is taken care of. You can disperse this billion. Uh-huh. And I'm going to pay you, not I being the person, they're going to pay you $10 million a year to manage the disbursement.
Yeah.
What do you think you would spend your money on if you didn't have to sacrifice to be a patron?
I would do pretty much what I'm doing now at a much larger scale. It's like just tracking down the most talented people I can find. I'd ask them right away, like, what are the dream projects that you have in your head or in mind? How much do those cost? And I'll hand you the money and just go like door to door and do that 10,000 times. And that's what I see as a way to contribute all kinds of great new artworks into circulation, I guess.
How would you consume art in your free time? Would you be sitting in a beautiful garden, listening to your favorite music, to your favorite sculptures and mosaics?
I have to figure out how to peel myself away from Bitcoin Twitter. That's like my,
well, you can have your phone like with my, you.
That's my major problem right now, is I can't look away from Bitcoin Twitter.
I hear you. And what is it about Bitcoin Twitter in terms of what excites you about Bitcoin right now? If there was a tweet that really gets you going, is it what kind of is really interesting to you about Bitcoin right now?
It's like it's almost like a light switch. It's like if you can get everybody to flip the switch and flip into a Bitcoin standard, that just changes everything in terms of someone's personal wealth and their ability to act freely in the world. And I see signs of it that people are adopting it very quickly now. And yeah, like others have said, it's just giving me an incredible amount of optimism for the future, not only for myself, but for others as well, like all over the world.
Do you think a Bitcoin standard could lead to an art renaissance? And I'm not talking about the Renaissance period and what that art was like. But just...
Yeah, I look at it as you really need to find the people that are naturally drawn to patronage and make sure that those people have Bitcoin. I think it's probably backwards to just kind of hope that people will become effective patrons just because they have a lot of money now. I think you'd have to think of great patrons being as rare as great artists and try to track them down first and make sure that those guys have Bitcoin.
How do you think of, what do you think of a world without Bitcoin right now?
I'd probably be more depressed than I was in my early 20s, to be honest.
Right.
In my early 20s, I saw it was mainly like a lack of meaning that made me really depressed. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what I could contribute to the world that would have meaning in it. And I think all of the things that I'm doing now are a response to that version of myself. And that includes transcriptions. It's a very meaningful thing to do for me.
What is that kind of the definition of meaningful for you, I guess, in terms of like, why do you think these things give you meaning? And I guess what I'm getting at here is what is valuable?
Mm-hmm. I think I would probably say what's valuable to me is individuation, no matter who it is, and just making sure that it's possible for people to like become the best version of themselves. And that's very broad, but I really think that Bitcoin allows that all over the world it gives people the option of becoming the best possible version of themselves and having the free time or the free resources to pursue anything that they want that would lead them in that direction. Because I feel like that's what my parents were able to provide for me, is like an environment where I could very slowly discover what I was best at or what I was most interested in and found the most meaning in. And that took a very long time. I don't think it was until I was like 25 or 26 that I really felt like I was in the right place mentally. And then it was like 2016 where I felt like totally locked in on feeling like I was doing exactly what I should be doing.
Right. Well, yeah, that's, I think, you know, in a lot of ways the brain isn't even fully formed until 25. So I fully understand that sort of path. You know, I think it's a little hotwired before then. Do you think, have you been having conversations with the artists that you work and sponsor about Bitcoin?
Yeah, with everybody so far. I guess some are more able to save in Bitcoin than others, but everyone's aware of it. And one is even like trying to convince everybody in his community to adopt Bitcoin as a savings vehicle. So they're all very enthusiastic about Bitcoin, and I think in the coming years, it should help them a lot. They're all aware of it, and they all want to save at least like 10% of their savings in it.
Hmm.
What can I ask you a question, Cedric?
Yeah.
What has been your experience with artwork in museums?
Well, I mean, I grew up going to museums on school field trips, so it was a nice way to get out of school in some regards, but I found them non-inspirational. I do find there's always this quasi mix between work that's been curated for me, and I wonder how much I like it because I've been told to like it, and I battle that intrinsically. And then, you know, then there's the little things that I find that I like. And those are the things I get more to because that's what I like. And that is, you can't put a dollar on that or anything like that. It's just either it could be a trinket or it could be a great piece of work. But for the most part, I'm not enamored with the idea of going to museums at all. I don't like going into room of art. Mm-hmm. But I do, you know, once in a while there is I like museums that specialize in things, or like there's a certain like a room I really want to see, not I want to see, or like someone maybe told me about and like, yeah, I'm interested in that. I don't find myself just wandering in museums for fun. I do go to Europe and that was, you know, you end up in the museums almost to check them off your list.
Yeah.
And I think we spent more time trying to find a way out of the Louvre than our time in the Louvre, and we took a lot of funny pictures in there. But things like, you know, going to see the Mona Lisa, it's just not, you know, it's under 3 inches of glass. There's 40 people surrounding it, and you don't know what your real reaction is. One of the things I did travel 3 months by myself in the South Pacific. And what was amazing about that is you wake up in the morning and you have a decision. Do I want to go on this excursion or adventure and go hike up this volcano or not? I'm by myself. It's not like I'm going to go stand there next to somebody and take a picture or take it in and have the experience together. It's on your own. And you really do find out what you want to do. Do you want to go to that museum and walk around it by yourself or not?
Mm-hmm.
But there are certain things like when I went to Alcatraz when I was a younger person, like that was really an interesting place to be. Or like Pearl Harbor in Hawaii, or even like Yad Vashem in Israel was a museum that was really impactful to me. I want more art in my world and in my life. But I don't have a lot of faith in the art world. And I think what you do is very gutsy because you put a lot of faith in others. You know, and I'm sure you're developing the relationships, and it just seems very, it's very gutsy to me. It's very admirable, but and it just seems like, even if you created you sponsored the greatest piece of work in the world, would people even know? In my mind now, like certain things get flooded, that, you know, good piece could get flooded by bad pieces. There's no curation. And then not that we want curators per se, you know, that's the whole Bitcoin mantra. Like, I don't want someone curating for me unless I choose to listen to that person maybe, but you know, it's kind of like do your own research.
I think at the moment, I'd be satisfied if like just one person in the world was totally like stoked that something exists that I sponsored.
I think that already happened. I went to your website. There was a piece that I just loved, and I was looking at a lot of them. And I went there with low expectations. And I was kind of blown away. And then I had to have that conversation with myself am I blown away because Steven picked this out and he's showing it to me? And I'm looking at it, and I think I was blown away because I looked at this mass that was a mosaic, and it had this beautiful blue in it that I loved. And I loved the pattern, and I got a sense of what you were talking about in the documentary. But I don't get that. It's few and far between for me. And like I was even on the board of a museum here in my town, a Native American museum. And I never saw any pieces like that, by the way. And there were great pieces there. But it was really hard to, when you start thinking about the math and the calculations, like how much impact are we really having on the community? What is the best way to display these things and to get them out in the world? And all these questions, and I really struggle with music today, because I love music, but I really struggle with that notion of like this low time preference. You know, they get in the studio for a day, they crank it out, they're 22 years old. Have they studied music for their whole life? Is this pattern really something I want to sing next summer? It seems like most songs today are created for the season. So art, I do think we need more art in the world. I just see it as an enormously uphill battle until maybe this period of affluence. And even in affluence, and affluence is not the right word, because I think we've had affluence over the last 40 years. We've created a lot of shitty art for the most part.
Yeah.
And it's not even shitty art. It's disposable. And it pays well for the most part at the top of the pyramid. So you see where the incentives are.
When I look at the artwork that was sponsored, like say in the past 50 years, it's possible the money just got into the wrong hands, and we just need to get more Bitcoiners on board that have different opinions on what to spend the money on.
Right.
That could solve the problem right there.
I 2 years ago, I won, or maybe 3 years ago, won, I shouldn't be the word. You go to an organization that your children goes to, and they have a charity auction, and you bid. And it was something like the photographer here, he's supposedly nationally renowned for his pet portraits. Mm-hmm. So very similar to what you were talking about, where people are very happy to sponsor. I never thought of it that way, but they're sponsoring art for themselves, for self-consumption, self-braggadocio. But, they love their dog, And so I think I bid $150 for a $700 package.
Yeah.
Great. I can get a family portrait is what we did. Mm-hmm. And it was funny because, I think it was like a 10 by 12 or an 8 by 11, whatever it was. He has odd sizes. So I paid for an upgrade to get the 16 by 20. But in the 16 by 20... he then, the way he cuts it, he signs it, which really I don't want his signature on my family portrait. And I've yet to frame it, because it was so expensive just to, I had to pay, it was like $300-$500, and I've never even framed it yet. It's kind of still awkward because, it's a portrait of us. Where am I going to put that? And I'm furious that his signature's on it. and I keep telling my wife, I want to cut that off when we actually frame it. And we battle over that. And it just makes me think of the state of art today. And people, he's the most renowned artist in town, or maybe, I don't know if that's true, but he's got a prominent storefront. And people go to get a 20 by 20 of their poodle.
Yeah.
And that's more important to them than all the things we've been talking about. And yet at the same time, I don't begrudge them. I might make fun of them, but I don't begrudge the decision. I just don't see them being incentivized to do the mission you're on. And I believe it's a mission for you. And it's a very, I think it's fantastic.
It's probably very different mission. But it's like, I don't know, you probably need both sides of the coin in this art world. I think of what I do as a very unusual path, and you probably can't expect too many people in the world to want to do it. But they're probably out there. There's probably like at least a dozen people in the world that want to do something similar to what I'm doing. But I can't see it as being very common.
Yeah. At the same time, I do think like, you know, you're building a very interesting and valuable skill set, which is intuition in a lot of ways, which only a few mm-hmm. people or a dozen people in the world will have. I have been in apartments. Michael Steinhardt is a collector of Egyptian art. He's a famous hedge fund manager.
Yeah.
His apartment in New York City is just inundated, and I don't mean that in a bad way, with Egyptian artwork and artifacts. And
yeah,
you know, at the same time, I mean, it wasn't cluttered or anything, but like, and it was enjoyable, but I mean, it was kind of selfish in a way too. I don't mean selfish, but you know, he's not sharing with the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they're rare artifacts. And I just really struggle like with that Rothko experience and the notion of that the money will dictate what people like more than taste and intuition in and of itself. And I think you can fabricate markets that way. It feels very disheartening. And not until sort of like the Bitcoiners, in my opinion, or the economic majority, so I think we have a shot at overhauling artistic impression or taste.
Yeah, it's interesting that the best patrons that I can find were maybe from the 50s or 40s or earlier, 1940s, 1950s, 19th century.
You're not talking about the CIA, are you?
Okay. I don't know too much about that actually. But
I do believe it. And
it sounds very plausible that happened.
And it's completely changed my opinion on government funding of art.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, and I think it subjects artists to taking that funding as a way to survive, with because I don't think the artist is necessarily being malicious or has mal intent or. You know, that I don't think they want to be mal-incentivized. But that's the money spigot in a lot of ways. And there's a lot of countries that have very formidable programs around that. But I think with good intent.
Yeah.
You know, but mm-hmm. I just wonder what impact that has.
Well, I read a lot of... I read a lot of opinions from old books where they really pushed to have state patronage of art. And I just can't see that being a good idea based on what happened in the 20th century. So it really just makes more sense for individual Bitcoiners to be the ones deciding like what artworks they want to be sponsoring. On an individual basis. I just look at like, I just see patronage as being most effective when it's one-on-one with individual artists and individual patrons.
How much joy do you get out of the relationship and working with the artists and influencing the work in the ways that a patron can? And maybe you could elaborate on that. Like, how does a patron influence the work? Or do they? Maybe they don't. I'm sorry.
I mean, that's probably where I get the most value out of the relationship is being able to ask questions, seeing the process of works being created from beginning to end over a period of like 2 years or 1 year. And being able to like pinpoint certain techniques and asking questions about the technique, or like how, like where did you get these diamonds or something? How did you source these diamonds? Or where did you source these the tessera that go into the mosaic? And can you still buy those today? For someone like Yuri, he has this whole stockpile of mosaic materials that you can't even buy anymore. It's all out of production. So it gives me this whole window into an entirely different life and an entirely different perspective on the art world. Especially someone like Philip Slater, he's probably in his late 70s now, and he's seen so much of the art world with a very critical eye. And it's fascinating to kind of pick his brain on how he looks at the world now. And he's terrified of the government, by the way, and how they've been treating the vaccine programs and everything. Mm. So he has a very rare perspective on the art world, which I think is coming from a very conservative lens. Even though he was in like LA and in touch with all of the galleries there. So it's fascinating to speak with someone like that.
Do you have any heroes in the art world? I hate to use the word heroes, but do you have any models or examples of a life well lived in the, on the art world? As a patron?
As a patron, I mean, the most influential would probably be Isabella Stewart Gardner in Boston, or in the Back Bay, actually. Because that's just what I grew up with. And visiting her museum, she was looking for living artists at the time, more than 100 years ago. And I think to a larger extent, the Phillips Gallery in Washington, D.C., he built an entire gallery that only showed living artists that he was sponsoring. And that was only oil paintings, but I think that was the right idea. It's like, how can you create an oasis for living artists and for this one patron to be sponsoring the work that he personally loved? I think that's something that had a huge impact on me. Hmm.
I guess my final question is, you know, in the grandiose scheme of things, Bitcoin goes parabolic, mm-hmm. short term. How does that change your patronage?
I mean, I probably have a couple dozen projects that I would start launching right away. It's like a giant to-do list. I have a couple dozen projects that I'd like to do. And once I run out of those, I have to go back to the drawing board and do a lot more research on Instagram to kind of figure out what other things I should be doing. I'd like to branch out into music and supporting musicians to record new albums. That's something I haven't really done yet, but I'd like to. And who knows, like it could be like Bitcoin devs or something, just start supporting people from all over the place, different disciplines. So it's an open book that I have yet to write.
Fair enough. If there was, I'll make it a two-parter, my final question. Yeah. So is there a piece from the last 10 years that maybe you haven't sponsored that you think, or 10 or 20 years or some period short term that will last for 500 years or that will really speak volumes millennia from now?
I mean, the one that I can think of right away is there's a museum called the Audain Art Museum, Audain, in Whistler in Canada. And there's this giant screen that was commissioned for this museum as the centerpiece. That's a Native American work or a First Nations work. I don't know, you'd have to look it up online, but that's a really powerful work that I've seen recently.
When you say a screen, you mean like a big...
It's almost like a door or a gate that's completely covered in sculptures and inlays and stuff like that.
Have you been there?
I haven't been, but I've seen a ton of photos of this work, and it was commissioned. Especially for this museum to be the centerpiece of it. That's one piece that comes to mind that I really think will be appreciated a few hundred years from now.
Do you ever hear of Andy Goldsworthy, the land artist? You asked me earlier about art. He's probably the most moving thing I've seen in the land.
Okay.
Yeah. I watched this documentary on him and I was very moved by it, by both him and by his work.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if you've seen it.
I haven't, no.
But his work, it's called Rivers and Tides, the piece I saw, the documentary, but he does a lot of work with rivers and tides as well as like stones. And it's all with like kind of, I wouldn't call it landscape art, but like he'll work with leaves and then the leaves will change colors over seasons and create a new kind of image. Or he'll create a stone wall that's kind of like an S shape squiggly throughout a whole forest.
Yeah.
Things like that. Or he'll build a sculpture in the ocean that will, then the ice will come in, like the water will freeze and create kind of like an ice sculpture, and then it'll melt and then float away and create a floating sculpture.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah. And I don't know if you saw this movie, Russian Ark.
No, I haven't seen that one.
I haven't recommend that. Yeah. Well, this has been incredible, Stephen. I really enjoyed this. And I can't tell you, I mean, I've really enjoyed the transcripts as well. And I did really enjoy going to your webpage and seeing the artwork that you have sponsored. I do think it's some really magnificent stuff. So please let everyone know where they can find you and the stuff that you sponsor.
So my website is Chow Art Fund. It's CHOW artfund.wordpress.com. And then I guess you can watch me in real time on Twitter at Chow Collection, or also on Instagram is where I post more of the art related stuff on Instagram. That's also Chow Collection.
Awesome.
Yeah,
man. Thank you so much. It's been so dope.
Stephen Chow on Transcribing Bitcoin Podcasts, The Art of Patronage, An Image as a Rapture, right here on the Bitcoin Matrix Podcast. And thank you for listening. If you dig the show, make sure to subscribe, share, and learn. Stack sats, stay humble, and hang on tight. Bitcoin is just going from no value to all the value in the world. Should be fun. This is Cedric. Peace.